don't need no education. Welcome to Education Nation, where every Saturday morning at 10:30, we grab our second cup of coffee and tackle the biggest issues in American education. Your host is the headmaster of Liberty Classical Academy, Rebecca Hagstrom, along with co-host Pete Hegseth. School is now in session.
Well, good morning, and thank you for joining us here on Education Nation. I'm your host, Rebecca Hagstrom, and it's always such a fun and great time to be able to join you on Saturday mornings. And I'm joined in studio once again with Education Nation producer Mark Durkin.
Good morning.
Nice to see you again.
You as well.
So are you on your third cup of coffee again this week like you were last week?
Every single Saturday morning.
We always say the second cup of coffee, but Mark is always on his third.
Let's get that caffeine boost going.
Right. Well, we are going to be tackling an issue that has increasingly turned into a kind of a national, I don't know that I would say a debate, but I think just where people kind of are confused over this topic. And it finds itself front and center on many different forums, when social media and that type of thing. And this morning, that topic that we want to tackle is the role of faith and science and how faith and science have really interacted with one another throughout the course of human history. And really, I think by the show's end, our listeners might be surprised to discover that faith and science actually have been linked together for longer than they have been argued as two antagonists, which is pretty interesting. So joining us this morning to discuss the history of faith and its compatibility with the field of science is Dr. Naomi Dillner. She is a science teacher at Liberty Classical Academy, and Dr. Dillner holds her PhD in molecular biology, biophysics, and biochemistry. Dr. Dillner, thank you so much for joining us today on this important topic.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Yes, and that's what I was just going to say is for our listeners, you need to go back and hear the great show that we had with Dr. Dillner talking, it was before Christmas, actually.
Yeah, this was on STEM education.
On STEM education, yes. So I would encourage our listeners to go back. Dr. Dillner is a very knowledgeable person, and it's really nice to have you back in the studio today. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. So we want to start out by talking, we're going to kind of do a timeline here for our listeners.
Right.
And we're going to start talking about ancient Greece and really what was the role of faith and science at that time.
Right. So what I think is really interesting when you look at the history of Western culture is that faith has really been a strong component throughout the development of all of Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
We hear a lot today that it has to be entirely separate,
mm-hmm.
And that maybe even if you listen to Richard Dawson or Neil deGrasse Tyson, that, you know, people who have a faith shouldn't really be doing science.
Mm-hmm.
But really,
wow.
I know.
You have to check your worldview at the door when you do your career.
Right. Yeah. Any worldview except theirs, anyway.
Yes.
You know, I was surprised. I started teaching and learning more about the history of science is that that's really par for the course. People of faith doing science because they want to understand their God better,
mm-hmm.
that's really par for the course.
Yeah.
And it's really a little more of an exception recently in this postmodern era,
yeah.
that those have been separated. I mean, even if you
very
go back and look at ancient Greece,
mm-hmm.
you have people who are doing science then, or kind of a version of what our scientific method is today, would be the astronomers,
mm-hmm.
and the physicians, the
mm-hmm.
doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors all belong to, they kind of were under the jurisdiction of Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they took the Hippocratic Oath, which all doctors in ancient Greece took the oath,
mm-hmm.
it was an actual oath that they made to Apollo.
Hmm.
And the idea that there was this God watching them,
mm-hmm.
holding them accountable, was a really big deal.
Right.
And one of the problems was that doctors had access, you know, like they do today, they had access to, you know, different kinds of drugs and poisons.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was always a fear, you know, what if your enemy, especially your political enemy, right, just paid off a doctor to give you poison instead of, you know, your cough medicine or stomach medicine.
Right.
Right. That was a real fear. So part of the oath was that they would never give any of their patients a poison that would would kill them. They mm-hmm. would never, ever do that. Mm-hmm.
And they were making that oath before the god of their time, which was Apollo.
Absolutely.
One of the gods of their time.
Absolutely. It was mm-hmm. an oath sworn sworn in front of other doctors and mm-hmm. in front of Apollo. Mm-hmm. And it was very important. It was considered a moral activity. Learning about the human body and having this knowledge, mm-hmm. it was inseparable from morality, and the way they lived was very important, just as important as what they did. So, I thought that was pretty interesting.
That is interesting that it would date all the way back to, obviously, you know, Western civilization now was founded more on a Judeo-Christian ethic. But interestingly, because the topic that we're talking about is faith and science. So though it wasn't a Christian or Judeo faith or Jewish faith or, you know, even a Hindu faith, it was still a faith. There was a belief in a God, and they were attaching their study of science to their belief in God. Interesting. For the most part, except that you said there's a little exception, right, Mark?
Yeah, those were the Epicureans. When they studied nature, they, I think, believed that you couldn't have anything supernatural in it. Is that correct?
Right. So the Epicureans, at the time of kind of the height of the Hellenistic culture, the Epicureans were kind of the agnostics and atheists of the time. They didn't really want anything to do with the divine. They did do some science. They came up with the word atom, even though their idea of what an atom was
a little off.
Well, you know, I read it and I'm like, how is this not spiritual?
It's interesting. Very mystical. Really? Oh, yeah. Interesting.
It's very mystical. But they did believe that everything was made up of these little tiny particles. So So they got to name the atom.
Interesting.
But they were, philosophically, they were basically the hedonists. Well, I mean, moderate hedonists of the day. But again, you don't have the atheists and agnostics doing science and the people with faith not. Mm-hmm. What you have is generally people with faith doing the majority of it.
Very interesting. Yeah. And then there was a time during Aristotle's time. Do you have anything that you want to say about his worldview and how that related also to the study of faith and science?
Right. Well, Aristotle was a giant. He was Plato's student and did a lot to kind of expand on his work. Mm-hmm. He wrote the first kind of textbook of biology, if you will. He kind of founded zoology. So he did a lot of I guess what you would call a version of science. Mm-hmm. He wasn't one of the hedonists. Mm-hmm. You know, he held to different views about deity. So I think it kind of, you know, when you look at the greatest minds of our time, mm-hmm. or not of our time, but throughout all of history, mm-hmm. you know, what we see is people who do have a faith that's very important to them.
Interesting. And they're trying to look at the natural order that was created by their God that they believe in.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, at his time, the deductive and inductive reasoning wasn't really separated out. So they didn't have a formal scientific method. Mm-hmm. So now, if we want to show that something is scientifically valid, we have to do an experiment, mm-hmm. right? And prove it and show data.
Right.
I mean, data-driven everything these days.
Right.
Sure. And and so they didn't really separate just kind of reasoning things out in a logical way and actually doing a test that was kind of combined. That kind of comes later.
Okay. Yeah, well, and I know, go ahead, Mark.
Well, the Aristotle thought, too. I mean, that train of thought was prevalent until around 1600s. Is that correct? I mean, it was for quite a long time.
Right. And part of that was because he just made giant leaps forward in terms of how people understood the world and the way it worked. And it also included the findings of Ptolemy, he thought there was a geocentric universe. There was one Earth, and everything revolved around the Earth. And actually, that worked really well for a long, long time, until people started needing to do more complicated things. It kind of broke down a little bit.
And there was a time when you said that the church dominated the science, which is very interesting. I know that. you know, the scientists, I guess I'm at this point talking about more of the Christian faith. And that would have been, what would that be, the Middle Ages, that that became much more common, where the church dominated the scientific realm, where the scientists were kind of tied into the church, with, per se? Was that the medieval times? Or
right. So okay. During the medieval times, especially when the Catholic Church was the main, pretty much the only way to be Christian, mm-hmm. What you had was, you had the church issuing formal statements. They were the arbiter of truth on everything. So not just a theology, but mm-hmm. also the natural world. So, you know, if the Pope said the planet moves a certain way or the stars move a certain way, then they do because the Pope said it.
Right. Okay. Right. Got it.
Yep.
And that's where Galileo ran into some trouble, right?
Sure.
I mean, that was during that time that he discovered that things were not the way it had been stated, and then he did get in trouble with the church, correct?
Right, yeah. He was he recanted, and because he recanted, he was put under house arrest. They didn't kill him.
Okay.
But yeah, it was a problem because in the church at that time, you had people like Thomas Aquinas and the Scholastic movement, and they really felt like if you sat down and really logically thought about things, you could probably figure out most everything you need to figure out, mm-hmm. just sitting down and chatting with people.
Yeah.
I mean, a little more than chatting,
yeah.
right? A little more rigorous.
No, not data-driven back then.
No, so didn't really need to back things up with... there were logical standards, but mm-hmm. but the requirement for evidence wasn't quite there.
Not as rigorous as it is today.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
And I think there was an itch that was certainly starting to build, about to go into some of things deeper. And this really led us into the Reformation period. You know, it was mm-hmm. Martin Luther who championed the idea that God calls people to do different things, and that non-vocational Christians, they thought they could honor and glorify God without living in the convent. And that really opened the door to inquiry, where it had become more acceptable to basically go ahead and start asking some of those deeper questions.
Right. Martin Luther had, he just had a profound impact on everything that was happening during his time and basically everything that that came after it. So Martin Luther introduced this concept of vocation. And that concept was that God, as a Christian, God calls you to do something, and it may not be being a priest, mm-hmm. so or a nun.
A nun. Mm-hmm.
So if God calls you to be an artisan or a craftsman or a merchant or someone who spins yarn, okay, if that's what God is calling you to do, then you honor God by doing that the best you can. Mm. You can glorify God through your work. And it doesn't necessarily have to be work for the church. I mean, that's good, obviously.
Right,
but,
right. It's not that that's bad. It's just
right.
that it was an expansion of thought.
Right. You mm-hmm. weren't less of a Christian because you did a secular job. And mm-hmm. and really he... right. And so this really opened the doors for people to be comfortable in their own professions, and people started asking more questions. And I wouldn't say that Martin Luther or John Calvin championed any particular scientist or any particular scientific idea, but what is notable is that right after the Reformation, all of the advances you see, the most advances you see in technology and science are occurring in countries like England and Holland and the Huguenot part of France. And then shortly after that, there was a counter-reformation in the Catholic Church, and then science and technology began to flourish there too.
Wow, that is very interesting. So as we pointed out at the very beginning, we can really see that throughout history, leading all the way up through the Reformation and afterwards, there really was a deep connection between faith and science, which is just, I think it's astounding. I think most people would never have guessed that that's the case. So we're going to take a little bit of a break here. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about a few other time periods and leading up here to the modern times. And we can't help but to show the necessity of faith in the investigation of science, even in the modern realm. So stay tuned.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Well, welcome back to Education Nation. I'm your host, Rebecca Hagstrom, and I'm joined in studio today with my co-host, Mark Durkin, and Liberty Classical Academy science teacher, Dr. Naomi Dillner. And we've been talking about the crucial role of faith in the study of science. And we led all the way up to through the Reformation period and a little bit beyond here. We're taking you on a flyby.
That's a lot of years in a short period of time.
Exactly. So, Mark, the sense of scientific exploration with God at the center really only intensified after the Reformation.
Yeah, that's correct, Rebecca. After the Reformation, people started asking all sorts of questions about nature, and this was significant. And I'd like to have Dr. Dillner, in continuing our discussion, discuss the significance of the Royal Society. Now, from what we understand, this was a premier scientific organization where Puritans were the vast majority of attendees. And knowing their history later of exploring to the land of America, were obviously under the conviction that it was okay to ask questions and explore.
Right. So the Royal Society still exists today. And
oh, really?
It's still one of the greatest honors an English scientist could have, to be inducted into the Royal Society. But before there was the Royal Society, there were a few little organizations in Cambridge that started to coalesce. One of them was called what they called the Invisible University. And this was a group of people that got together to meet, that ended up talking about scientific ideas. Hmm. And that coalesced with a few others to come up with, to begin the Royal Society. So they applied to the king for a charter and got the charter. And then they had a Royal Society where they could talk about their ideas and share papers, things like that. Hmm. I think it's really interesting that at the founding of the Royal Society, Puritans were a minority group in England at that time. They were kind of pretty fervent. But the majority of people in the Royal Society at that time were actually Puritans. So these are people that are really serious about their faith,
right?
People whose faith takes an effort. They have to be different from the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And so that just shows that a strong faith, once again, we see is coupled with scientific discovery, starting something new,
right.
Starting something that's really going to help and benefit humanity. So
that is very interesting. And I know that there were a couple of specific people that you wanted to highlight that ties into this whole notion of the connection between faith and science at that time. So this would be after the Reformation, Robert Boyle being one of them, and Isaac Newton. Do you want to talk a little bit about the two of them?
Sure. Robert Boyle was a very prominent scientist around when the scientific method was becoming more formalized by Francis Bacon and that group, also a member of the Royal Society. And Robert Boyle... first, I think it's important to understand that almost all these men wrote apologias for their faith along with their papers.
Interesting.
Which I think is
really
right, is really interesting. Mm-hmm. They couldn't help talk about how these new discoveries and new ideas related to their God. And it's kind of inspiring stuff to read.
Sure.
So, like, if you read Robert Boyle, he says things like, the study of nature is to the greater glory of God and the good of man. So, instead of, you know, in society today where we're what we're fed is that religion is going to hamper science and it's going to be kind of a drag on it. Mm-hmm. What we find throughout history is that you have people who really want to know their God and know that they can understand more about him by exploring creation this way. And It seems like when you read their writing that they're kind of exhilarated about this. They're really excited about this. It's a lot of fun things to read. And so I think that's interesting. Isaac Newton, of course, also wrote a few different essays accompanying his work, especially Principia Mathematica, about understanding God's glory through nature. He also did a little theology. So again, I just want to make the point that you can have fervent religious faith and be pushing the boundaries of scientific discovery and exploration at the same time. That's common in history.
Interesting. And actually, when you think about it, it really does make sense, because there is this notion, this belief that you can learn more about, as you said, about God or about the world that has been created by God. And so it would feed the inquiry. rather than thinking that maybe it just sort of happened to be here, you know, would there be so much inquiry if there isn't that connection?
Right, because I think for the Christian, inquiry and figuring out nature mm-hmm. and figuring out the way things work in the world, it just compels us to worship mm-hmm. the Creator. Mm-hmm. And I think because it's tied to that worship element, it's a really wonderful thing. So I think for the, you know, as a Christian, learning about scientists and new discoveries, and even when I used to work in the lab, to me, it was a very exhilarating thing that pointed toward God, and that just led me to worship Him.
Yeah, wow, that's beautiful. Well, then we're going to fast forward again from the post-Reformation times to the Enlightenment. And not as much time travel there, but still a significant amount. And it was really during the Enlightenment period that we began to see this separation form between faith and science. And there's a movement of scientism that I know that you want to talk about. And, you know, the influence of Charles Darwin and Albert Einstein. So why don't you kind of talk about some of those elements of Enlightenment times with science.
Right. So the Enlightenment is a time where people are believing in the power of human reason and logic, and you see really great advances in technology, in the scientific mm-hmm. method. Mm-hmm. Discovery now is happening at an exponential pace. So I think most people assume that because now we have somehow faith separated from reason, that's what's making the science take off. Mm-hmm. But I think that's an assumption that's not quite correct, because if you look at the actual people who were making the discoveries, who were doing science, you had many of those people who still had very fervent faiths. I mean, think of Pascal. Mm-hmm. He wrote poems about the Holy Spirit, you know.
Wow.
So very, very fervent in his faith. So I think even though that's kind of the underlying assumption in the postmodern world mm-hmm. is that, well, once kind of we went
once
more
we
toward
were enlightened,
reason.
Yes.
Once
mm-hmm.
we were enlightened, mm-hmm. then it could really take off. Mm-hmm. But really, all of the at that time men who were making those profound discoveries and advancing technology, were most of them were believers.
Wow.
And so I don't think you can really say, oh, well, now that we became secular, now science is mm-hmm. advancing. Mm-hmm. I think maybe there were a few more secular people than there had been before. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was becoming a little more popular. But in terms of as science goes, it's still being done by people of faith.
Yeah, it was still dominated by faith. You know, one of the other people that you've mentioned is Albert Einstein and his theory of relativity, and just his whole view on God. And I think, again, people might assume that because he came out of that Enlightenment period, or I guess he's post-Enlightenment,
right.
that he, too, was an atheist or an agnostic or someone who certainly wasn't letting faith impact what type of science he was doing or who he was giving credit to.
Right. Well, Einstein was a deist, and mm-hmm. he believed in God because he just couldn't wrap his mind around the fact that you could have laws of the universe described by these simple, elegant equations that worked so well, and that there couldn't be some kind of a God. He could not wrap his mind around that. And a matter of fact, he kind of was at odds with some of the later physicists that came behind him in quantum theory, mm-hmm. Because he felt like he couldn't kind of get that into his picture. He wanted the elegant equation. He didn't want probability. Mm-hmm. But again, I just want to make the point that I don't think Einstein was hampered by any kind of belief. I think it's one of the drivers of inquiry. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole idea that the universe makes sense, mm-hmm. that we can understand it springs from idea that God is a God of order, and we can understand God. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we can understand his creation, too. Mm-hmm. It makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So that takes us kind of post Enlightenment to really our almost our modern times. You know, Charles Darwin, when did he give his theory? Was that in 1860 something? I don't remember.
I feel
exactly.
Terrible. I should know. I should really know.
Anyway, but it was in the late 1800s, mm-hmm. and that really is when I believe the whole notion of a distinct separation between faith and science really took root.
Right, and I think what's interesting is his initial kickback. It didn't come from Christians; it came from other scientists, and then it was kind of later on as there started to be polarizing forces that it started to become more polarizing. I think there were people who saw this as an opportunity to define a worldview without any God. And so they wanted to jump on that and make sure that their worldview was pushed forward. But again, we can see from the ancient Greeks that being an atheist or agnostic, it's another worldview. Mm-hmm. It's not like having any other worldview, but it's taking their own worldview and their own thoughts about nature and then working them into their life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Very interesting. And that is kind of brings us really to our modern times where there is this sense that they should be separated and that Darwin's theory of evolution would have demonstrated that they're, you know, isn't a God involved in creation, so why would you ever try to bring faith into science? And you've been researching the discoverer of quantum theory, and why don't you tell us about him?
Sure, and this is because I was really interested in, especially at this postmodern time that we're at, did you kind of see were Christians not engaging anymore in terms of Nobel Prize winners, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that there are a lot of people of faith really engaging with science. And
even now.
Even now. And, you know, the one example that comes to mind would be Reverend Dr. John Polkinghorne. He was a physicist at Cambridge for about 25 years. He helped do some of the work that led to the discovery of quarks and gluons, which are subatomic particles. So he did really significant work. One of his students went on to share in a Nobel Prize. But he also, after his work in physics, became an ordained Anglican priest. And he's written extensively about this intersection between faith and science. And he uses an analogy that I just love. What he says is, I need the binocular approach of science and religion if I am to do any sort of justice to the deep and rich reality of the world in which we live. And I think that is so true. If we really want to understand the world that is so complex, we really need both science and religion to get the real full, rich understanding of the world.
Yeah, very interesting. So really, the essential question in both religion and science is the question of truth. And so if that's the case, why wouldn't we want to use all the tools in our toolbox, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, I hate to say that we are at the end of our time. It has gone so quickly. And I hope that all of our listeners go and spread this podcast around to others for their listening pleasure. And I want to say thank you again to Dr. Dillner and Mark Durkin for joining us in studio today. And I hope that all of you join us next week again when we come back for another program of Education Nation.